Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University African Studies Center in the College of Arts and Sciences, titled A Black Panther in Tanzania. Our speaker is Mama Charlotte O'Neill, co-founder and co-director of the United African Alliance Community Center in Tanzania. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Barbara Brown, Director of Outreach for the Boston University African Studies Center.
I am delighted and, in fact, honored to introduce Mama Charlotte O'Neill to you. She is a Black Panther from Kansas City. She is also a long-term permanent resident of Tanzania. Mama Charlotte is also a poet, published poet, and a musician with a CD, and has just been on a speaking reading tour in South Africa, Malawi, and Zimbabwe at the invitation of the University of Natal, Durban. So I thank you for honoring us with your presence. I am delighted, of course, to see you again, Mama Charlotte, and you just keep on coming back.
Well, thank you. Yes. And I appreciate seeing so many people that I know. This is like a family reunion, y'all. You know, it really feels good. And I want to welcome y'all. I do want to correct my sister Barbara. It's more than one CD. Thank you, ma'am. This is actually my fourth, both music and poetry. And then I have two new DVDs out of my poetry. Yeah, so thank you for that. So what we're going to do is I'm going to share a little bit of our history, just a glimpse into our history, and share even more about the work that we're doing these days in Tanzania, the United African Alliance Community Center. And this work that we're doing is informed and is indeed a continuation of the work we were doing as members of the Black Panther Party. I'm so proud of that. I'm so proud of that history. I'm so proud that I was a part of the 60s, you know. And during this Heal the Community tour, this is what I always tell young people like yourselves, you know, that being a part of the 60s and that whole vibe of building community and peace and love and solidarity, it was something unusual. My husband, Brother Pete, my husband of 42 years, I must say, Pete O'Neill, he likens it to kind of a special alignment of the planets, you know? And it's like they were in this special line and it was shooting out some kind of love vibes or something, because this wasn't happening just in America among the young people who were rallying around issues like the Vietnam War and the beginning of the feminist movements and of course, the end of the civil rights movement and all of that. This was happening in Africa, where countries were first being liberated and starting to govern themselves. This was happening in Europe, where students were getting out and protesting the injustices that they were seeing. It was happening in South America. I think my husband was right. It was some kind of special planetary alignment. And I'm telling you, I'm seeing it again. I'm seeing pockets of this same kind of peace growing, this urge to come together. I don't know if you all are seeing it here in Boston. I'm hoping you are. I'm hoping you are. And if you're not, you need to do what you can to start this special peace vibe going again. That's my mission. My mission is to both inspire, to be an example, and to spread peace and love. My husband always tells me that I'm like an old hippie. And if being an old hippie means spreading peace and love, then I claim that. So I am all of that, but I'm also a wild woman. I am a wild woman. I'm a panther woman, a warrior woman, a warrior wild for peace. And I will take you by the collar and come up close to you and get all up in your face. and make you drool and get wet around the edges for the taste of it, peace. For the sweet of it, peace. For the addictionness of it, peace. And I am a wild woman. I am a panther woman, a warrior woman, determined to make you want a piece of this peace that we must spread onto every slice of humanity, of family that we can reach with our sharp weapon of peace. And I'll take you roughly by the wrist and twist you back around and twist and twist and twist and turn your mind to the point of understanding. Mwafaka. Don't worry, that's a Kiswahili word. And that word means understanding. Understanding, overstanding. Who would ever dream that a word so close in sound to a sound of hurt, of rage, an impotent curse could mean such a gentle, necessary, vital thing. Mwafaka. There was a time I was afraid to say that word. So afraid I might mispronounce the sounds and inadvertently spew out that rage word. You know the one I mean. The symbol of much hissing, negativity whose sounds used to be used in careful and meaningful and powerful and heartfelt descriptions, now reduced to mere embellishments of radio sounds. And I am a warrior woman, a panther woman, a warrior woman wild for peace through empowerment, through pride, through creativity, equality, through love, 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 L-O-V-E, y'all. So, you know, my husband emphasized how the work that we're doing as members of the Black Panther Party, what we're doing now at UACC, which is United African Alliance Community Center, is indeed a continuation of that work. You know, so many people, when you think about the Black Panther Party, you probably are referring to some of the negativity that was constantly in the news media. You know, if you looked at the newspapers and the TV stations back in the day in the late 60s and early 70s, you would probably think that the Black Panther Party was a group of very violent, racist people. And it was anything but that. The Black Panther Party, of course, was formed, if any of you all know the history, it was formed out of a need and out of a desire to offer some kind of protection to a community that was just being so brutalized by the police in those days. And I must say, I was gone 20 years before I came back in 1990, and one of the first speaking engagements that I did in Kansas City on the program was the community coming together to speak about this African-American priest who had been brutalized by the police. And when I got up to the podium, I said, man, this is like deja vu, you know. So many of those issues that we were dealing with back in the day, they have almost escalated in the 2000s, in 2011. And that's a sad thing to me, you know. But we were so much more than just a self-defense organization. As a matter of fact, as time went by, community service is the thing that became foremost in our programs and in our actions, because we realized that there were so many needs that needed to be met in our communities. Things like feeding children. We had breakfast for school children programs all across America. Every chapter was required to have a breakfast program. And this was well before America, the United States government, ever instituted these free breakfast programs. Our programs were the pilot project, and is what pushed America along. The city governments and the state governments, I guess the federal governments, pushed them to also have these kind of programs. And, you know, when I go speak before college students and high school students, I always tell them, we were your age. You know, we were like 15, 18, maybe the oldest Panther, at least in Kansas City, was 30. And this was happening all across the country, y'all. You know, and it's almost hard to imagine that we were teenagers and coming together for a cause like this, to feed children, to set up free health clinics, to rustle up lawyers who were able to advise people about their rights free, to find transport for families who needed to visit their loved ones who were incarcerated and who otherwise wouldn't be able to do this without the transport that we provided free. So all these kind of programs were happening all across America. And at the same time, there were counter programs that were happening. And this was instituted by COINTELPRO. And I hope some of you all will go, I hope all of you go online and find out more about this government program. It was instituted by the FBI, COINTELPRO, the Counterinsurgency Intelligence Program. And this was designed to cause dissension among not only the Black Panther Party, but all these progressive movements, because we were working together. We were changing the mindset of thousands and thousands of people. And some of the powers that be found that this was threatening. It couldn't have been the fact that we were ready to defend our communities. It couldn't have been that. Not when America has the largest arsenal of weapons on the planet. That couldn't have been a threat. The threat was the solidarity and the fact that we were changing people's mindsets. We worked with so many progressive organizations, the Young Lords, the Brown Berets, the Red Berets, the White Mother Country Radicals. These were all people who were determined to do what we could to support our communities, to uplift our communities, and to come together. That continues to mark me, continues to mark the woman that I am, continues to inform the work that we do. I can't say that enough. So, as you see, Brother Pete was also one of the leaders who was targeted. He had that case. He had two other cases pending. So we left and we resurfaced in Algeria. Algeria was the host or the hub of the liberation movements of the world in those days. You could find any liberation movement, the ANC, SWAPO, FRELIMO, the North Vietnamese, the North Koreans, everybody was there. And we all had embassy status. And that was something that was very unusual for literally lay people. None of us had trained to be ambassadors, but here we found ourselves in that role. Eldridge Cleaver and Kathleen Cleaver and some of our other comrades who had gone into exile were the founders of the international section of the Black Panther Party. Brother Pete and I worked there for 2 years. That's where our son Malcolm was born. I'll never forget this. It was in a Chinese-run hospital up in the mountains, and everybody either spoke Chinese, Arabic, or French. And here I'm a 20-year-old, never had a child before, and trying to be as stoic as possible because these were Chairman Mao's folks, you know. And there's no way I was going to show any pain, and I didn't. But I learned the Lamaze method, too. I talked to you about that. Yes, yes. And so that's where Mao was born. And we worked there. We had great experiences. We had a daycare center. You know, everybody shared kitchen duties. You know, And we live communally the same way that we did when we were in Kansas City and that all chapters did back in the day. So after 2 years, there are various things happen, and to save time, you can go online and find out about that also, because my concentration, I want to concentrate more on the work that we're doing now. I would like to advise you to learn more about COINTELPRO, Black Panther history, and that whole era if you go to itsabouttimebpp.com. itsabouttimebpp.com, no spaces. And you'll find not only archives, but also what's happening today. So we started hearing a lot about Tanzania. In those days, there was a pretty large population of Africans from the diaspora living there. And many of them actually came from the Midwest. Why? Because President Julius Nyerere, the founding father of Tanzania, had issued a call to Africans in the diaspora, in particular, to come and participate in nation building. And many, many people answered that call, and they started telling us, you all need to come here. The atmosphere is beautiful. The socialism is strong. Elders and youth are working together. There's communal farming, the whole thing. And they said the weather was good. So we went to Tanzania. Dar es Salaam. Knew nothing about farming. Knew nothing about doing any kind of homesteading. But once we got there and once we moved to Arusha up in the mountains, we were determined that we were going to learn. Some of the elders in here might remember the Mother Earth Catalog. Any of y'all remember that? The Mother Earth Catalog became almost our Bible. Because it taught you how to homestead. It taught you how to raise chickens and even build windmills and preserve food and all of that. Because we knew nothing. We were from Kansas City. And you know, many people think if you're from Kansas, you automatically must know about farming. Well, we city young folk didn't. All we'd seen is maybe our grandfather's farm or something like that. So we became homesteaders. We had a lot of false starts, especially when we would try to plant and dig holes a foot deep, and our neighbors thought that was the funniest thing they'd ever seen, and took us under their wing to teach us better how to raise our own food. And I tell you, we became expert. Raised all of our food, never had to go to the market. In those days, I might have gone to town once a month under duress because I would rather stay at home. Had huge calluses on my hands. So did my husband, who formerly had very soft hands. We raised thousands of chickens, supplied the hotels with our chickens. Huh? I became expert at milking, and I always like to ask people who are listening, any of y'all ever milked a cow? Not one person. You have? You have, Barbara? Okay.
In Embassani Village.
Oh, okay.
Like the laughter of my host family.
Yes, yes, you know, and it was probably quite a scary experience at first, because when you first milk a cow and you're sitting on that little stool and that cow is just huge, you know, and you don't know if it's going to tip over or if it's going to kick you, and you have to learn how to tie the tail down and tie the legs at the same time and feed it a little something so it'll be distracted. But I became expert. I would milk that cow and get like two big 20-liter buckets of milk every day. And if you have that much milk, you have to know what to do with it. So I started a little cheese business. Made our cheese, made our yogurt, made our butter, made our heavy cream. You know, it was good. Go out and pick your fresh eggs. You know, this was living off the land. We even had windmill electricity and a water windmill also. Brother Pete actually carved the propeller of that electric producing windmill. And so we lived on that farm for 6 or 8 years. And we said we need to, and we were renting. So we wanted our own land. Now, in Tanzania, if you're not a citizen, you get a title deed, and you can, every 99 years, you can renew it. So we figured that was okay. You know, we got a few more years before we renew it. And we moved to Embassani Village, where many in this room have been, right in the foothills of Mount Meru, right at like 5,000 feet. Beautiful. If there's an Eden in the world, that is it. And we started building our homes, and we used a Semvaram machine, which was first created in Brazil. And this allowed us to make bricks that were, you know, stronger than cement blocks. We were able to do that and so many other innovative things, to the point where elders started actually sending their young people there to apprentice with us, because what we were doing was so different. And they said we worked so hard. So it became so congested with young people coming there every day that we said we need to be more organized. And this is how the first center was born, out of that need. So things have continued to grow organically. We saw that we needed more classrooms. We started building classrooms. You know how some people save for a vacation? We save for a bag of cement. And that's how we did over the years. We'd have a little something, get a bag of cement, till we had enough to build a wall. Hello, how are you? Yes. Till we had enough to build a wall, enough to roof something. I'd like to point out that we just recently had, I'd like to call it kind of a barn raising, but it was actually a roof raising, where people in the community got together with a group from Corpe Diem, and we actually roofed one of our classrooms with new thatch. That's just an illustration how many, many times throughout the years, the community will come and help us do whatever, because the community is part and parcel of what we do. The community dictates what we do, what programs that we should have. This is why we have 150 students now. And they said, well, why don't y'all teach us English or French or Spanish? And that's what we have been able to do. We have a computer there. We're the only place that has Wi-Fi in a village. And not only do we have these programs for our students, but the teachers in the community in some of the primary schools are able to come there, do research, and download lesson plans. We have music classes and a music studio, filmmaking classes and editing. We feel in fine art and crafts, and even this was made by one of the children in our children's home. You see how pretty that is? 2 years ago, we established the Leaders of Tomorrow Children's Home. Why? Because, again, it came out of a need that needed to be addressed. The elders came to us, and they wanted us to do something about the growing number of children. And we, one of our Buddhist friends, she was able to help us build the house for these children. When I left Tanzania to start the Hill Community Tour mid-February, we had 20 children. Now we have 23 children. Some of these children are orphans. Some of them come from very destitute backgrounds, and all of them are being thoroughly loved and taken care of and educated. And to see the change in these children now is astonishing, because when they first came, they were so withdrawn. Physically, they weren't in good condition, and now they have just blossomed. And we make sure that whatever these children want to be in life, whether it's going to be the next president of Tanzania or a doctor or a teacher or whatever, we make sure that all of them will also be artists, because we understand the empowerment that comes through being considered an artist, you know? We have the Empowerment Through Arts program, and it's working. It's working. All of our teachers are volunteers, and many of them were students themselves in the program who come back and are inspired to volunteer the knowledge that they have learned. We host many study abroad groups, and these youth come, and they also volunteer their time. Community service is the thing, the seeds, the very important seeds that we feel must be planted. And I'm telling you, those seeds are sprouting. We have so many young people who are in competition to see who can volunteer the most. Young folk. And this again reminds me of how it was when we were Panthers. We were the same way. So the spirit of the Panther Party is alive and well in Tanzania. You know, I love to share this poem because I think that everybody can relate to it. And it, again, illustrates some of the things that I had to go through when we first came to Tanzania to feel a part of the community. I wanted to be considered purely an African woman. I didn't want anybody saying I was African-American. That would upset me. I tried to put all of my experiences in America, almost all of them, out of my mind because I thought I had to be a certain way to fit into the community. And so many young people and elders go through this all the time. I went through it to the point where I almost lost myself. It used to amaze me that even though pre-dreadlocked, dressed in conga from head to toe, carrying my babies on my back, basket on my head, chewing sugarcane sticks and pepper-sprinkled mahogo roasts, just like everybody else. Before I even opened my mouth to speak, they could somehow tell that I was someone else, different, other than. I couldn't hide it, even though I tried, and I almost lost myself, self, self. In my freshly landed, just got off the boat enthusiasm of living in Africa, I tried to blend, to melt, homogenize, disappear, erase the essence of what made me who I was and am, an African who grew up in and was molded by the hoods of America, and I almost lost myself, self, self. I almost lost that distinctive stride that signals she ain't from here. Anatoka Mahali and Guinea Bwana. I almost lost my fierce, laughing in your face sister tone of voice and my hands on hips, finger waving, snake charming. You ain't about to tell me I can't. Neck moves. I tucked that me tightly under my conga wraps and demure gaze and soft, gentle handshake. And I almost lost it in giving it up. But I woke up just in time and place and attitude. I had to learn to remember that the I that is me has a history as rich and as valid as anyone born with the dust of our African ancestors sprinkled lovingly between their baby toes. I learned to remember that the Middle Passage memories still twisting in my DNA, causing frequent bouts of claustrophobic episodes, are as real as the recollections of those who had never been ripped from the reassuring womb of family and history and language and food and religion. Religion, religion. I learned to remember that the French etymology of my name was just as valid and honorable and blessed as Habiba's or Amina's or Aisha's, because it was given to me in love by those who loved me and marked me as surely as the eternally swollen scarification cuts of a Dinka lady. I learned to reject feelings of embarrassment at having been born an African in America, off land, offshore, thousands of miles off course from where I might have been had those captors not had such a pressing need for dark rum and cotton gins. I've learned to remember and bring honor to the fact that I'm still the fly in the ointment, the lump in the clotted cream, the wrinkle in the dried cloth, that hard green pea under the stack of mattresses. And after having lived in Africa for going on 40 years, I'm still different, set apart, Negro. But hey, it no longer bothers me that folks still ask me, even after I've explained that I've lived in a village in the heart of Wameru homeland in Africa for years and years and years, probably even before they were born. It no longer bothers me, I tell you, when they say in response to my explanation, yes, yes, I do understand that, but now watch out. Here it comes. Here it comes. Here it comes, but where are you from? It's been quite a journey from being a young girl in Kansas City to the Black Panther Party to United African Alliance Community Center, and now a 60-year-old woman who feels 25 most days, except when I'm in the cold like in Boston. My knees remind me that I'm 60. And it's been a blessing. I have done so much in my life in this short time. And to be able to see children blossom, to be able to affect youth from all over the world, to be able to inspire, to be able to live my passion and represent my husband, that is a blessing that I just can't hardly explain. And I think I'm going to share a song. You think I'll share that song, sister? Yeah. Okay. Because when you've been on this planet for as long as I have, you're bound to have experiences that you will never, ever forget. Things that make you want to laugh. And things that you might just want to tuck away to take a peep at through tears every now and then. But living long also teaches us that it's all good. It's what makes us unique, makes you, you, and me, me. There ain't too much I have not done in my lifetime. Ooh. My life's been so full. There ain't too much I have not touched and felt and tasted. Ooh. My life's been so full. I've seen the death of my own mother, the birth of my godson. Ooh, yeah. My life's been so full. I've watched my children grow into adults that I'm proud of. Yeah. my life's been so full. I've watched the sun rise up over Kelly's left shoulder. That's Kilimanjaro, yeah. My life's been so full. I've watched yellow flowers fill city lots off jam-packed highways, yeah. My life's been so full. I watch my body change, but my smile stays the same, yeah. Ooh. And it's still full, already full, already full, yeah. My life is already full of blessings, y'all, full of love. And I hope you're inspired to spread the love. Please do. Keep that 60s vibe going. Let's open it up for some questions, okay?
Hi, Linda Haywood, the director of the African American Studies Program and an Africanist, so I am just intrigued by the sort of transnational diasporic experience that you have just laid out us.
Yeah.
And I wanted to go back to something you said about being, you know, still the outsider, no matter what or how long you have kind of gone back to Mother Africa. Mm-hmm. And my experience in Angola and in Zambia, where I spent a year each, in fact, is very reflective of that outsider status. And that sometimes I deliberately would ask Africans, you know, I'm your brother, I'm your sister, I'm an African. And my response would be, no way, you're an Mzungu. And I wonder if this, so, and that cultural word Mzungu, which in fact means foreigner, white.
Yes.
I wonder if there are certain words or terms that are used in Tanzania for that sort of outsider
status. It's Mzungu.
Mzungu.
It's the same, it's the exact same word, you know. And luckily, because I have been in that community so long, I'm certainly not considered an Mzungu anymore. You know, but because I don't know my exact tribe, and in Tanzania, you're supposed to know your tribe, you know. I have been able to pick and choose all the tribal designations from all over Africa, and I have taken it a step further. And I feel that I can choose from any community. I don't care if it's African, if it's Chinese, if it's whatever, because I know that I am a part of the global community. So, you know, it's always going to be, you know, like, for instance, somebody asked me, Mama, where are you from, you know? And I said, well, I'm from Tanzania, you know, because I have lived in Tanzania much longer than I've lived anywhere else. I've lived there 40 years? Since 72. So, mathematicians, how long is that? 40 years, and lived in Africa almost 42 years. I lived in America 18 and a half years. And so when I say, well, I'm from Tanzania, and they start saying, oh, no, 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 you're not. I said, no, why do you say that? They said, you speak with an accent. When I speak Kiswahili, I have a Kansas City accent. They said, and you don't look like a Tanzanian. Now, people will tell me that, oh, you might be from the Maasai tribe, you might be from the Wachaga tribe or whatever, but I don't dress so much like that. I was the first woman in Arusha to have dreadlocks. This is my second set of locks, but I had star locks in 85. Now, even that was like almost scandalous, you know, because nobody was doing, if you had locks in those days, it meant that you were off in your head or something. And then, you know, I wear bindis. You know, and you don't, well, at least back in the day, you wouldn't see an African woman with bindis, you know. People relate wearing bindis to the Hindu community. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I always remind people, indigenous people all over the world mark their third eye, you know. And that's what I'm doing. I'm marking it as a symbol of peace and love. Huh? It's things like that. And then even the fact that I've had my ankles wrapped by Maasai women, and nobody does that anymore, you know, except the elders. Sometime I'll be in town at the market or whatever, and an elder Maasai woman will come up to me and just hug me because they're happy that I am carrying on a tradition like that. When I got my marks, my scarification marks on my cheeks, so many people were saying, that is the craziest thing to do. Why? Because in these so-called modern times, you don't see young women doing or young men doing that anymore. But I'm also on a mission not only to spread peace and love, but to keep traditions like this alive, you know, traditions like rituals, coming of age rituals and things. I'm a ritual woman, you know, and where many people think that's kind of odd because Christianity and Islam don't necessarily promote that. You know, so for me to be embracing things that our ancestors used to do also marks me as an outsider, you know. But like I said in my poem, I am thoroughly cool with it. I have come to the point in my life, I'm going to be me no matter what, you know. I work with a lot of the young artists there, in all spheres, especially the hip-hop artists, huh? Hip-hop in Tanzania is a very, very strong social force. And the artists there have literally taken it back to the day, to the way it used to be, the way it originally was, where it was used as a tool for inspiration and upliftment and empowerment and all of that. And they've taken it even to the point where it's used as a means to promote traditions, you know. So you'll see some of the hip-hop artists, you know, rapping with Maasai warriors, you know. And I'd be right up on stage with them, you know. So I commend young people who are looking at hip-hop as a tool to join all the youth of the world. And I'm always telling elders, and I'm usually the oldest person at the concerts or on stage or whatever. I say, if we're talking about being able to communicate with youth, you better learn the language of hip-hop. Because that is the thing that you can go to Siberia, you can go to Mongolia, you can go to the Amazon forest, and you're going to find somebody who is communicating in hip-hop, you know. So I say right on to that, as long as it's socially conscious, you know. I don't know if some of you might be familiar with the group Dead Prez. Dead Prez, who are socially conscious artists, M1 of Dead Prez came to Tanzania with Umi, who's of a POW, and they came there, and a film was made by Michael Wanguhu. And it's, I'm sure the premiere here in Boston, it just, I think the first premiere was last month, and it's called Niwakati. And what they were doing was exploring the relationship between M1 and Umi as progressive artists, the Mau Mau freedom fighters, the Black Panthers, who were represented by myself and MZ Pete O'Neill, and the conscious hip-hop artists of East Africa. And they made a wonderful documentary. So y'all be on the lookout for that, too. Niwakati by Michael Wanguhu, who is also the filmmaker who made Hip-Hop Colony, which was about the pioneers of hip-hop, the conscious hip-hop artists in East Africa. And I'm so proud to have been a part of that. You know, M1 even gave me a shout-out in one of his songs. You know, so again, that marks me as an outsider because I can't think of maybe one other elder, maybe two other elders that I know in Tanzania who really have anything to do with hip-hop artists, you know. So, hey. sometimes it's good to be an outsider, you know. Yeah, an outsider on the inside.
Hi, my name's Kelsey Alexander. I'm a student at Boston College, actually. And I really love this philosophy that you guys have about making sure the students are also artists. And I was just wondering if you could talk more about sort of where that came from and why you felt that was so important and how that's come to be your philosophy at the center.
You know, and it's not really an original idea, because I think everybody's an artist in some kind of way. I think that that is instilled in us the moment that we're born, but I think it's almost beat out of us. I think that that is the thing that causes a person to blossom, to be able to be creative, you know, to be able to know that you have a voice, not only in your public speaking or your poetry, but that you have a voice and the right to talk about your ideals and your feelings. All of that comes out of being an artist and exploring your creativity. You give a child, and you'll see this when you come, you give a child a piece of paper and ask them to talk about themselves, you know? And they'll be able to express themselves like that, and be through poetry and through what we call maigizo, which means like skits and plays. The youth and the elders are able to free themselves up to talk about topics that they would be too shy to talk about otherwise. We have a lot of plays or maigizos that deal with the subject of HIV/AIDS. Things like that where people wouldn't dare talk about, but they'll make it in even a comedic kind of way, you know, teaching through the arts, teaching through music, teaching through the visual arts, you know. So I know the empowerment that comes through that. I can see it with our 23 children who are at the Leaders of Tomorrow Children's Home, and how now that they are being recognized and they have a chance all the time to get on the microphone in front of the community, you know, and we had some students from France who volunteered and came and taught them juggling and poi, fire dancing, but they didn't do the fire poi. They just did the, you know. And I mean, they are just strutting with confidence and with pride. We've had young women who come there who have just been to primary school, and many of our students have just been to primary school because there's a shortage of secondary schools, and now that it's not socialist the way it used to be, parents have to pay, and these are very, very poor parents who can't afford. So the classes that we're able to offer kind of fill that gap, you know, vocationally and educationally, right? And so there's been sisters who come who have never picked up a little paintbrush, probably never even seen one before, who learn how to be painters, who have exhibited their work in the National Museum in Dar es Salaam. I bought their work here, and it has been exhibited. They have been able to make money from their families by being an artist. You know, the students who are now making CDs in our recording studio and who are professional now, you know. So the empowerment through the arts is something that's real. It's something that is workable. And it's something that's really easy because it's natural, you know. So, yeah.
I'd like to ask if you would like to say a final few words or poetry or song, or if you would just like to say Asante Sana, thank you. I leave that to you, Mama Charlotte, and then I will close with thanking you.
I would like to share a short poem with y'all, because you know, people are always, because I travel and I'm the one who I'm able to represent Brother Pete, you know, and I like to make sure that he is in the forefront of everything that I do. And this poem is called Wife Pleasure, because like I said, this is my 42nd year with Brother Pete O'Neill, and I feel so blessed, and my pleasure at being a wife is immense. The joy of knowing that I can be myself with my mate of nearly more than four decades, even when there is morning breath after a rough night, dusty paint-sprayed feet after working at my art all day, and terrible snoring most nights. And to know that I am still loved and honored is a delirious pleasure to me. To know that it's okay to sit in silence or laugh hysterically with my man anytime, any day, makes me feel more blessed than one can ever know. To know that we both enjoy the same sunset and sunrise, yet accepting each other's vast differences as individuals that make up the whole that is our we, makes me feel so secure and loved. To know beyond all doubt that we remain in love even when we fuss and disagree, to still be able to look at my man and feel the heat rising in my luscious thoughts about him, gives me great pleasure, even after all these years and years together. What a blessing our love is. So y'all spread the peace, spread the love. Let's be an example to the youth who are coming up today. Let's bring the 60s back. Thank y'all.
All I can say is what a blessing too.
The Sante. Sante ni sana, y'all. Sante. Sante, yes.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You have just heard a lecture by Mama Charlotte O'Neill, co-founder and co-director of the United African Alliance Community Center in Tanzania. Mama Charlotte's lecture was titled A Black Panther in Tanzania and was presented by the Boston University African Studies Center in the College of Arts and Sciences. Tonight's moderator was Barbara Brown, Director of Outreach for the African Studies Center. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, WBUR.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Paul Vikas. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.